10 seconds what this means for Paris 2020, what this means for next year.
Well, what it means is that people are the only hope, that we need a powerful movement built here in Europe and around the world that holds our leaders accountable, that puts their feet to the fire, that sends them with a mandate to Paris to actually negotiate in good faith and to deliver an agreement that is good for the planet, good for the poor, and actually changes the kind of economic system which is driving us towards this climate
catastrophe. We have to leave it there, and I thank you so much for being with us. Asad Rehman of Friends of the Earth, Suzanne Goldenberg of The Guardian, speaking to us from Lima, and Nitin Sethi, speaking to us from New Delhi of the Business Standard in New Delhi, India. That does it for the show. I'll be speaking December Tuesday night in Washington, D.C. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke and Apel Saramate. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Sun Lee, the membership coordinator at KBOO Community Radio. I just want to take a moment to say thank you to all the people that made our three-day December drive a rousing success. From our volunteers that answered phones, created great programs, and engineered live music, and to all of our listeners that called in or donated online, and to the restaurants that donated food for our volunteers. I would also like to thank and welcome the 40-plus new members to the KBOO community. Without your support, KBOO would not be what it is today. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the City Repair Village Pollinators Night on Thursday, December 18th at 6:30 p.m. Village Pollinators Night features Erin Cornell sharing how her neighbors became motivated to paint their intersection, plant a community garden, and the connections they made along the way. Again, that's Village Pollinators Night, Thursday, December 18th at 6:30 p.m. at Ex Novo Brewing Company, 2326 North Flint Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News, so stay tuned.
This is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, protests against police violence continue across the country, and in Portland, we'll get a full report.
Postal workers occupy a Staples office supply store in Portland to protest the privatization of the Postal Service.
The U.S. Senate approves a trillion-dollar budget, which includes numerous unrelated measures, including deregulation of the banking industry.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 15th, 2014. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. The recently formed group Don't Shoot PDX held a rally yesterday in North Portland linking the gang-related shooting at a Portland high school on Friday with the recent spate of police violence nationwide and calling for real reform and the end of violence in communities of color. For more, KBOO's Kayla Tatum spoke with Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot PDX.
Tell us about the protest that was conducted in Portland yesterday, December 14th. How did that go?
Oh, it went pretty good. Usually our Sundays are used to organize and do planning, but since we're in the 12 days of mourning and it was the anniversary of Sandy Hook and some other things that happened in our community in regards to the shooting at Rosemary Anderson, we thought that it would be fitting to do a community action protest in that area. And it went pretty good. We did basically a gentrification tour. We marched from Rosemary Anderson down Mississippi Avenue and through a lot of the communities over there that have experienced violence. based on the root causes that cause violence, crime, and gangs and all that other stuff.
So I would like for you to tell us, what is Don't Shoot Portland?
Don't Shoot Portland is a community action plan. We've been meeting together since August after the shooting and murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And over the last couple of months, not only meeting with different organizations, but individuals in our community that have never had a voice that could be used to help plan and create solutions. And so as a community with all these different partnerships, we've been balancing out the voices of those that have been unheard to make sure that we use our voices together in unity to speak directly to our policymakers and the politicians that run the state and create laws.
And what is your involvement with Don't Shoot PDX?
I'm a lead organizer. I've actually been on the front line since August and scheduling meetings, organizing with the different people, working out the logistics of who wants what done, and making sure that we've been fair and balanced and obligating ourselves and our coalition to focus on those efforts that people need outside of the bureaucracy that happens within government, just trying to push the movement for people.
How do you feel the recent incidents of police brutality, which have made national news, relate to the situation in Portland?
Well, here in Portland, we just had a report that was made available to the city from a civil rights organization called CIO, which was presented to the Portland Police Bureau and our city council on officer-involved shootings and in-depth custody issues. And so in that report, it detailed about 7 incidents between the police that ended up in some type of assault or murder. And this is the 3rd report. We have several that came before it. And if you go to our city archives, there's even more going back into the 70s and even back further to the 50s. So police involvement in shootings and in-custody deaths is not something new to Portland. And it hasn't, you know, we're just making sure that people here know that the same thing that happens in Ferguson and New York and Utah and Ohio has happened here and is continuing to happen here.
Do you feel as though these nationwide protests that are happening in Portland and nationwide will eventually create a change?
Oh, I believe so. I think that the people being able to have their voices directly heard by policymakers in a big global movement is that's extremely strong. That's powerful. And it can't be ignored, and it's not going to be suppressed. So I think that it is going to make a change.
Okay.
It's basically direct engagement.
Are there any upcoming protests that will be conducted that you want people to know about?
Oh, absolutely. Tonight we're having a planning meeting at Portland State University in the Smith Hall. And then we plan on demonstrating at a local McDonald's 4:15 now, because we believe that poverty is the root cause of violence. And that's within our long-term focus. And then tomorrow, I believe that we're going to be trying to shut down the Hillsborough Police Station. We want to protest there because we've got a lot of calls from minorities that live in Hillsborough that are dealing with the stop and frisk and the, you know, the pullovers and things of that sort. So we want to let them know that this isn't just a Portland problem. This is happening throughout the state of Oregon. And I think we made that very clear when we went to Salem. But we'll be in Hillsborough this week. And then we have a couple of other things planned. We'll be in City Hall on Wednesday. And throughout the week, you can just check our Don't Shoot Portland event page to see the additional upcoming events.
And has Don't Shoot PDX partnered with other organizations or groups in Portland?
Yeah, there's several organizations and groups. We just had somebody from the Human Rights Commission out in Beaverton come up and meet with us. And several. There's so many, I can't even...
Yeah.
You have to come to one of our planning meetings. But every person that's on the front line is representing a different community or organization. And so we just welcome that. We think that is very necessary for us all to do this together.
Yes. For people who want to get involved in Don't Shoot PDX and attend meetings and everything, how can they contact you?
We have a Facebook page called Don't Shoot Portland. We also have an event page by the same name that can be found on that Don't Shoot Portland Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And then there's also an email, and it's don'tshootportland@gmail.com.
I've been speaking with Teresa Rayford from Don't Shoot PDX, and this is Kayla from KBOO News. Thanks for listening.
3 hours prior to the Seattle Seahawks game yesterday, approximately 400 protesters marched through the streets of downtown Seattle and in front of CenturyLink Stadium against police brutality. According to K2 News, one protester said, "We're inviting Seahawks fans to be a part of taking a stand today." The protesters were peaceful, and there were no reports of confrontations or arrests being made.
In Oakland, California today, at least 13 people were arrested in a protest that blocked roads in front of police headquarters. Today's action was just the latest in a series of protests in Oakland and Berkeley that have resulted in over 200 arrests in the last 3 weeks. Davey D. from Hard Knock Radio and KPFA in Berkeley brings us the sound of protesters blocking Highway 80.
March on the freeway!
March on the freeway!
Want to talk about what's going on here?
Oh, man, we on 80, man, all the way from here to New Jersey, man. The people together will never be defeated. It's definitely been seen here, you know?
So it stopped in both directions.
Yes, it did. Both directions. The people are being held up. The people were persistent like a piece of water making the Grand Canyon, and they've made it, and they're making a point right now, you know? And I'm happy to be from Berkeley, California, where, you know, people at least, you know what I'm saying, are making a stand. Now, hopefully no one gets hurt, though. I understand the CHP is out here trying to get people hurt, you know, and but they did it.
Now, what we have here, they had a lot of police, but they couldn't go the full mile, a couple of miles.
Look at it, they got their hands up. Oh, that's beautiful, man.
So they got their hands up, so and people on both, both sides.
Wow.
Describe what you're seeing right now.
I see people on the other side of the street on their knees with their hands up, man. I mean, it made me cry, man. I love for Mike Brown. So, you know, you look at this and realize that, you know, there's a love of humanity, man. There's all races out here, all cultures and everything, all social, political things. But the one thing everybody have in common is justice, man.
That's real talk right there. We are sitting on Highway 880. Right now, people are yelling, hands up, don't shoot, while they're in the middle of the freeway.
Don't shoot, hands up,
don't shoot,
hands up,
don't shoot,
don't shoot.
A Georgia Congress member has introduced a bill to reform the grand jury system in the U.S. after a number of cases in recent months have resulted in acquittals of police officers who killed unarmed civilians. The recent incidents have shed light on the ineffectiveness of grand juries in convicting police officers who engage in wrongdoing. Representative Hank Johnson's new bill creates special hearings for police murders that would supposedly be more fair and transparent than the current grand juries. Johnson said in a statement that many people understand that the nation's grand jury system is fundamentally broken. The protesters demand an end to what is perceived as unequal justice and that those who are responsible for the use of excessive force be brought to justice. According to Johnson, the American people do not trust the current secret grand jury system. He says that his bill will help restore that trust by creating a new system that will allow police officers to stand trial for their actions just like everyone else. Johnson has also proposed legislation to end the Pentagon's controversial 1033 program, which has been arming local police departments with military weapons. Johnson is currently seeking co-sponsors for the Grand Jury Reform Act in Congress.
A New York resident is suing the police department for taking his money during a pat-down in October. A lawyer for Leonard Joy, a resident of Coney Island, said the police officer engaged in a, quote, strong-arm robbery. Luckily for Joy, his friend caught the incident on video, and the officer can be seen reaching into Joy's pocket and pulling out a wad of cash. The officer never reported the money to his superiors and apparently just took it for his own use. When Joy demanded his money back, the officer pepper-sprayed him in the face. Now he's suing the police department for robbing him, pepper spraying him, and doing nothing to the officer who carried out the attack. The New York Police Department issued a statement saying that people should not jump to conclusions from watching a 30-second video clip. In the same statement, the department blamed the person who documented the incident, saying, quote, "It is time to stop the amateur video activists who interfere with police operations." Police accountability activists challenged that statement on constitutional grounds, saying that it could have a chilling effect on people hoping to document police interactions with the public. The New York Police Department did say the incident is under internal investigation.
The families of the victims of the Newtown School massacre filed a lawsuit against the manufacturers and sellers of the Bushmaster AR-15 rifle used in that shooting. The lawsuit states that the gun should not have been sold for public use because of its powerful capabilities. The lawsuit, which was filed in state court and announced today, alleges wrongful negligence. The plaintiffs claim the defendants chose to ignore the risks that the rifle posed so they could continue profiting from the sales of the AR-15. The rifle was first produced by Armalite for military purposes, but Colt later acquired the design and began marketing the semi-automatic for civilian use. Since then, other companies have made and sold similar rifles. A 2005 law protects gun makers from most lawsuits over misuse of their products, but makes exceptions for cases where manufacturers should be aware that a weapon will probably be used in a way that creates danger for others. A lawyer for the Newton family said that this case has the potential to have wide-ranging effect with respect to the AR-15.
Pennsylvania police are searching for a suspect in the killing of 6 people in 3 locations near Philadelphia today. Bradley William Stone, 35, of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is related to all the victims, according to the Montgomery County District Attorney's Office. The victims include Stone's ex-wife, former mother-in-law, and grandmother-in-law, and sister-in-law and her husband and 14-year-old daughter. The police are focusing the search in and around Pittsburgh, which is about 50 miles northwest of Philadelphia. The killing started around 4 a.m. today when a woman was shot to death at an apartment in Lower Salford Township. 2 more people were found dead a half hour later in Lansdale, and then 3 more victims were found at a house in Suderton. According to neighbors, the first victim is Stone's ex-wife. The two had been in a custody battle over their 2 young daughters. A neighbor said she saw a man leave with the girls. The children later were found safe, according to local media. Stone served in the U.S. Marines, including a few months in Iraq in 2008, and then later as a reservist. Local media reported that Stone suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder and uses a cane or a walker. He's described as armed and dangerous.
Postal workers occupied a Staples Office supply store in Portland yesterday to protest the privatization of the postal service. For more information, I spoke with Jamie Partridge, an organizer with the Portland Communities and Postal Workers United, and himself a former postal worker. Jamie, dozens of protesters picketed the Jansen Beach Staples store yesterday. What's the reason for the protest?
We're protesting the outsourcing of post offices from public post offices to private inside Staples Office Supply stores. This is happening all over the country. The Postal Service had a pilot project with 82 Staples stores in the San Francisco Bay Area, Atlanta, Pittsburgh, and Boston over the past year. And just this October, they announced plans to open up these post offices inside of every one of the 1,500 Staples stores nationwide. It's the largest office supply chain, and that means they're coming here to Portland.
And what's the reason for the agreement between the Postal Service and Staples?
Well, the Postal Service says that they're expanding service to the public because Staples is open till 9 o'clock and open on Sundays. But the truth is that they're basically trying to bust the postal unions and move the outsource the work completely from public post offices to private Staples. Also, it looks like Staples may be merging with Office Depot and Office Max. And they're also signed off on a similar deal with Walmart. So we're having good union living wage jobs being transferred to low-wage, non-union Staples work.
So the people running the post office at the Staples stores are Staples workers, and they're not union postal workers.
That's correct. And they're getting very little training. They're, of course, high turnover because they're low-wage. And so not only do we have to worry about the impact of jobs, their wages going from, you know, decent living wage to poverty wage, but also the male sanctity of the male is in jeopardy when you have folks who are only getting 4 hours of training to handle everything from certified and insured and overseas mail to, you know, the weighing of parcels. And while they're at the same time taking care of other things in the store, we have testimony from folks in these cities where these postal, many post offices have been set up, that they've seen mail just sitting out where it could be picked up, where folks could, you know, the possibility of mail theft is very real in these Staples stores. And of course, we're not suggesting that Staples workers are any less hard workers than a postal employee, but you just know when people are in a job for a career like postal service employees are, that it's a different situation than when you have a high turnover employee base, and folks are having a hard time getting by. The potential of mail theft is much greater.
Are the functions being performed at these post offices at the Staples stores pretty much the same as a regular U.S. post office, I guess, other than actually delivery of the mail?
That's correct. Although there are no post office boxes, there will be pretty much all the services that folks expect at a public post office. That is, you know, priority mail, express mail, postage, weighing parcels, insured mail, certified mail, all those things.
And what's the objective of the protesters then?
We're trying to get Staples to get out of the postal business. We're encouraging folks to boycott Staples, to hurt their bottom line until they decide to get out of this postal contract. The American Postal Workers Union has called for a boycott of Staples stores, and we've been able to get a lot of support, particularly from other unions, but also just across the community. We've been able to get particularly important support from teachers and teachers' unions, who buy a lot of school supplies at Staples. In fact, I think 25% of Staples' business is school supplies. So we've been hurting their bottom line, and they're actually closing some stores, but they have not yet been convinced to pull out of the postal business.
Where can KBOO listeners go to find out more information about the boycott and to find out more about how they can support and participate?
Well, there's a website called stopstaples.com, stopstaples.com. So you can sign an online petition and learn more about the campaign. And if people are concerned about, in general, about the dismantling and privatization of the Postal Service, they can go to the website of Communities and Postal Workers United, which is CPWUnited.com. CPWUnited.com.
We've been talking with Jamie Partridge, an organizer with Portland Communities and Postal Workers United, about the protest at the Jansen Beach Staples store yesterday. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
Hundreds of volunteers in Seattle are giving back for the holidays. Eddie Wang, a University of Washington graduate, proposed an idea of volunteers giving sleeping bags to the homeless in King County. Last Saturday, volunteers provided over 3,000 sleeping bags to homeless men, women, and children. Wang's goal was to provide a sleeping bag to everyone in King County to help get through the cold winter nights. In order to cover funding for the project, an online campaign was created to raise money for the homeless. The campaign, known as Sleepless in Seattle, raised over $75,000, with more than 500 donors contributing to the campaign. Remaining sleeping bags will be sent to 20 nonprofit organizations around the county. Wang states, "I didn't know where the money would come from for this project, and I didn't know how we would get over 200 volunteers, and we've gotten all that, and we're bringing it together. It's just so cool to see people fired up about sharing something so meaningful with the community. Their mission was not to end homelessness, but to help those in need and show compassion."
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Voices of Grief and Struggle. Mothers come to Washington, D.C. to demand police accountability. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6 and Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Today in history, on December 15, 1961, Adolf Eichmann is sentenced to death after being found guilty by an Israeli court of 15 criminal charges, including charges of crimes against humanity, crimes against the Jewish people, and membership in an outlawed organization, the Nazi Party of Germany.
It's 5:25. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The spooks are spooked, not by anything that foreign enemies might do to America, but by what our CIA spooks and their political overseers did to America. By America, I mean the essence of our country, our ideals, and the moral values we hold up as a beacon to the world. That beacon shines less brightly today because of one word, torture. Even as the Bush-Cheney regime was professing that America does not torture, Bush himself authorized secret torture sites. The National Security Council approved the CIA's request to torture prisoners we held. And the Justice Department crafted secret memos to rationalize the torture. Now, the officialdom and spooks of that day are spooked, not because of what they did and then lied about, but because they got caught. The gruesome, nauseating details of their brutal torture of fellow human beings has just been documented in an in-depth investigative report by the Senate Intelligence Committee. So spooked is the whole hierarchy by the shamefulness of this, and so intense is their culture of denial, that even today's officials cannot bring themselves to say the word torture. John Brennan, the current CIA director, dodged the blunt truth of the word by saying, "I will leave it to others how they might want to label those activities." Activities? Do they think they can paper over the depravity of torturing people by calling it an activity? That only heightens the shame of what the hierarchy did in America's name. Brennan then tried to bury the horror by saying he hopes, quote, "we can put aside this debate and move forward." This is Jim Hightower saying, move forward toward what? If today's officials can't even call it what it is and simply move forward without holding anyone accountable for their criminal and immoral acts of torture, then future officials are free to do it again. And you can bet they will.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The former chief technology officer of an online bank has been sentenced to 5 years in prison. Mark Marmalev of Brooklyn, New York, pleaded guilty to charges in connection with his role in designing and maintaining the technological infrastructure for Liberty Reserve Bank. Liberty Reserve was a Costa Rica-based centralized digital currency service that billed itself as the, quote, oldest, safest, and most popular payment processor serving millions all around the world, unquote. The site had over 5 million users when it was shut down by the United States government in 2013, including 600,000 in the U.S. Prosecutors argued that due to lax security, alleged criminal activity largely went undetected. The Liberty Reserve online bank was shut down by U.S. federal prosecutors under the Patriot Act after an investigation by authorities across 17 countries. The United States charged founder Arthur Budofsky and six others with money laundering and operating an unlicensed financial transaction company. Liberty Reserve carried out tens of millions of transactions totaling $16 billion. Around $6 billion of that was drug money, according to federal prosecutors.
The U.S. Department of Justice has announced that they will begin to allow Native American tribes to grow and sell marijuana on reservations. This will occur even in sovereign Native territories that are located in states where marijuana is illegal. As more and more states legalize medical and recreational marijuana, it is becoming harder and harder for the federal government to classify marijuana as a Schedule I drug. Schedule I drugs are those with the highest level of potency in addictive chemistry. Other drugs on this list include heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamines.
Last Tuesday in New York, medical officials recorded the first casualty caused by nicotine-infused liquid. This liquid, meant to be vaporized and inhaled as an alternative to smoking tobacco, was ingested in a deadly quantity by a one-year-old boy. He was found unconscious in his home and pronounced dead at the hospital a short time later. Reports claim this is the first casualty of its kind. The only other liquid nicotine-related death on record is an adult male who injected himself with the substance. Bills in several states are seeking increased warnings, regulations, and child-proof packaging.
After 5 years of haggling about the XL pipeline, it may no longer make economic sense. With the GOP taking control of the new Congress, they may have a veto-proof vote, but plunging oil prices make the need for this pipeline questionable. Sandy Fielden, Director of Energy Analytics at Texas-based RBN Energy, says the economics of this project are becoming increasingly borderline. For the pipeline to be profitable, the price of oil needs to rise. Extracting the oil from the tar sands is difficult and costly. However, the pipeline backers have no intention of backing down after having invested in the pipeline for at least 10 years. Some say they have an obligation to their investors, and this is just a temporary setback. Republicans plan to take advantage of their majority with the new Congress and vote approval for this pipeline. Senator Jim Inhofe, Republican of Oklahoma, a longtime crusader for the project, says the pipeline's diminishing potential in the energy marketplace is beside the point. Oil prices and prices at the pump should have no bearing on support for an approval of the Keystone XL pipeline, he said.
Arizona Baptist pastor Stephen Anderson called for the execution of all gay people, saying that the Bible commands it. He says that Christians are not to do the killing, though, as that is forbidden in the Bible. According to Anderson, the non-Christians in the government should do the Bible's bidding to make an AIDS-free world by Christmas.
Net neutrality demonstrators interrupted the monthly meeting of the Federal Communications Commission on Friday. The activists unfurled a large banner reading, "Reclassify Now," behind the seated FCC commissioners. The banner was in reference to the decision by the FCC to classify the Internet as a broadcast-style entity as opposed to an information exchange like the telephone system. The activists, both union members, were escorted from the room by security after speaking out. They shouted questions at FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler, asking why he continues to delay Title II net neutrality, which should have been voted on at Friday's meeting. Other activists outside the meeting held paper signs calling for reclassification of the Internet under Title II without delay. Several stood up and spoke to Chairman Wheeler from the floor to ask why net neutrality was left off the agenda before being escorted from the room. Outside, a crowd of protesters gathered with signs reading, "Save the Internet" and "Reclassify under Title II." The reclassification to Title II would allow the Internet to be regulated as a telecommunications service, as opposed to the current proposal, which creates a two-tiered Internet in which big corporations have an advantage. Citizens have called the FCC over 400,000 times in the last month, and several polls claim that over 99% of voters are in favor of net neutrality. Digital rights group Fight for the Future helped publicize the protest and demonstration and vowed to continue to escalate the protest until a vote is made.
Under the threat of a government shutdown, the U.S. Senate this weekend passed a $1 trillion budget. During a rare Saturday session, the Senate passed the resolution to keep the government operating. The measure passed by 5 votes in the House on Thursday and by 16 votes in the Senate on Saturday. Representative Greg Walden was the only representative from Oregon who voted in favor of the measure. Hidden in the massive bill were a number of special interest provisions. These include nearly $500 million for fighter jets that the Pentagon had not requested. Another provision in the bill reduces food benefits for mothers and children under the WIC program by almost $100 million. One of the most controversial provisions in the budget, which nearly prevented its passage, is one which removes key parts of the Dodd-Frank Bank Regulation Bill of 2010. This means that taxpayers will have to bail out the Wall Street banks if they fail again. In addition, provisions in the budget will open elections to even more money from private interests and will nullify Washington, D.C.'s marijuana legalization measure. President Obama has promised to sign the budget despite all the special interest provisions included in the final version.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, December 15th, 2014. Israeli soldiers attack school children in the West Bank and open fire at farmers near the Gaza borders. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli forces assaulted a number of Palestinian students at a school in Burin village to the north of Nablus Monday, causing many cases of suffocation. Local news sources said that Israeli soldiers fired tear gas and stun grenades inside the schoolyards towards students lining up for class, under the pretext that the students threw stones at Israeli soldiers. The attack spread terror among students, many of whom suffocated due to the prolonged exposure to tear gas. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers on Monday closed a highway linking the southern West Bank town of Yatta and nearby small villages to allow a rally organized by Jewish settlers to pass, according to local sources. Coordinator of the Anti-Settlement Committee, Ratib Jabour, stated that the Israeli army closed the Highway 60, preventing Palestinian drivers from using it because the army stated that the settlers residing illegally in the occupied West Bank might organize a provocative rally. In Jerusalem, the Israeli municipality delivered on Monday demolition orders for the family home of Mu'taz Hijazi, who is suspected of attempting to assassinate extremist American-Israeli rabbi Yehuda Glick. According to the family, Israeli forces and municipality officials raided the Silwan home and delivered a demolition order for their three-story building, claiming that it was unlicensed. The home was built before the Israeli occupation of East Jerusalem in 1967. The family received the demolition order last month, but it was frozen until Israeli Supreme Court issued a final ruling, local news sources added. Undercover Israeli forces shot and killed Hijazi on October 30th of this year, hours after the shooting of Glick in Jerusalem. The initial autopsy report showed that Hijazi had been shot at least 20 times. In the Gaza Strip on Monday, Israeli military jeeps opened fire towards Palestinian farmers along the Gaza southern border region near the town of Khuza'a, east of Khan Yunis. Several Israeli military jeeps opened fire towards farmers who were harvesting winter crops in the land just adjacent to the border, local sources reported. No injuries were reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, December 15th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joanna Peterson, John DeAndrade, Kayla Tatum, Cherish Frazier, Ken Jones, Rosalind Scott, and Riley Turner. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. If you're listening to KBOO, you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe talk radio show, Joe Uris hosts a discussion of CIA torture. Why was torture banned in the U.S. and why is it back? At 9 on alternative radio, Vandana Shiva speaks on radical compassion and how the magnitude of our environmental crisis requires radical compassion for the Earth and all its inhabitants. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, D. May Roberts talks with three Portland authors about independent and small press publishing. Martha Hull, Sandra DeHellen, and Patty Duncan represent three different genres of books. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews the sculptor James Florschutz, who will talk about his show Wedges Plus at Augen Gallery. Florschutz works in woodmaking, abstract, and post-minimal installations. Thank you for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. And please remember the matching challenge for new memberships throughout this month. Go to KBOO.fm and make your gift. And stay tuned now for Voices of Grief and Struggle. Mothers come to Washington, D.C., to demand police accountability. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to WPFW's live coverage of the mothers who have lost children to police brutality. They've traveled here to D.C. from December 9th to 11th to demand police accountability. My name is Katia Stitt. The human rights of these young men, all of these sons, have been violated because of the extrajudicial killing of their sons. But the mothers have come together and formed an organization, and in fact, it's a broad coalition of folks, including Code Pink, the DC Hands Up Coalition, Mothers Against Police Brutality. And Ms. Flanagan was very clear when I spoke to her. She said, "We are here to ask for legislative accountability so that there is recourse when this happens. There are laws in place on the federal level that prohibit such a thing." She outlined all the reforms that have come, unfortunately, through her son's killing in Dallas, but she's worked tirelessly to get legislative reforms there, and now they are bringing their case to the nation's capital. And again, this is the congressional briefing of the Judiciary Committee, and we are using the hashtag Black Lives Matter, if you want to tweet, also the hashtag Ferguson, not D.C. Ferguson, but simply Ferguson. There are all of these hearts that have different messages decorating the room. One is handprints, and this says, "This stops right now." There's another one that says, "Police accountability now."
another that says end police brutality, another that says hands up, don't shoot, another one that says Black Lives Matter. There's a cross for one of the sons, Gregory Chavis. Rest in peace at age 19. He died October 9th, 2004. Then we have another cross, rest in peace again, Oscar Grant, age 22, died January 1st, 2009. John Crawford, beautiful young man, age 22, died August 5th, 2014. Dale Graham, died 28th of October, 2008, 29 years old. And then in the corner, there's another young man. The name is in glitter, so it is hard to read, but he was 18 years old, died February 2nd, 2012. I wish you could be in the room with me and see these bright, young, promising faces looking back at us that have been taken from us through police brutality. And these mothers have come so bravely, so eloquently, so graciously to say no more. Gregory Chavis again, age 19. Sean Bell, age 23. Michael Brown, of course, age 18. Archie Elliott, age 24. All of these signs, read these names. These are all men and young men and boys, really, that have been victims of police brutality. My name is Katia Stitt. We're awaiting our co-anchor, Askia Muhammad. And again, we're so happy that you're here celebrating with us this day for these mothers, for their sons. You know, the beginning of a groundswelling movement across the country. And this is a historic day. And we'll hear from these mothers a little later in the afternoon. But their courage is unparalleled. What they have come together to do, to say no more.
Okay, we're going to get started.
Now we'll go to the mothers.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for being here. Again, my name is Nicole Lee, and I'm an international human rights attorney and the immediate past president of TransAfrica. And I want to welcome you today to what I consider to be one of the most important things happening on the Hill right now. We are honored to have these very special guests who are here to